Imagine this. A scratchy radio call cuts through the night. 15 minutes, a dirt strip near the river lights up. Headlamps flash once, twice. Then a small plane, twin engine, just skims the trees. Lands fast on this like ribbon of clay near the Catatumbo. Loads up quick, gone again, back into the dark.
Yeah, it sounds cinematic, but you're right. It's the reality down there.
Exactly. And when you ask people on the ground near that Colombia-Venezuela border, you know, who really owns the night, the answer you get back is, well, it's Stark, it's gangs, it's dissident guerrillas, and crucially, cooperating security forces.
Right.
So our mission today is to get past those images, past the rumors. We're doing a deep dive into the official record here, looking at this alleged criminal government connection in Venezuela.
And we're using that stack of documents, you, our listener, shared official U.S. stuff, international court records, designations, policy reports. It's quite a pile.
It really is.
And what's, I think, really striking here is how the whole policy conversation has shifted fundamentally. Well, the sources, they show that Washington and key international bodies, too, they're not just wondering about state complicity anymore. They're officially treating significant parts of the Venezuelan state structure as basically an enabler for transnational crime. And this is the kicker, for terrorism.
Okay, so it's gone way beyond whispers.
Way beyond. We really need to grasp the weight of these formal legal actions. So today, yeah, we'll dissect those 2020 narco-terrorism charges against Nicolas Maduro himself.
Right.
We'll look at the specific sanctions that came down in 2024, 2025, hitting groups like Tren de Aragua, the Cartel de los Soles, and then crucially connect all that high-level stuff back to what's happening on the ground, you know, in those key corridors like Arauca-Catatumbo and the Orinoco mining arc.
Okay, let's definitely unpack that. If we're tracing this move, you know, from rumor to the official record, the U.S. Department of Justice seems like the place to start. What was that specific legal charge in 2020 that really put this on the docket?
Yeah, that was the big one. March 2020, the DOJ indictment. They charged Maduro, plus several senior allies, not just with, like, standard drug trafficking.
Yeah.
It was specifically narco-terrorism.
Narco-terrorism.
Exactly. The legal claim, right there in the papers, was a conspiracy with the FARC, which, remember, was a designated foreign terrorist organization. The idea being they were conspiring to, quote, flood the U.S. with cocaine as a weapon, essentially.
Wow. Okay, so linking drugs directly to a terrorism charge, that's a huge step up, legally speaking, but that's the DOJ, the legal arm.
Mm-hmm.
Does the State Department, the diplomatic side, see it the same way? Do their reports back up this idea of Maduro's people providing safe haven?
They absolutely do. Yeah, if you look at the State Department's own reporting, specifically their annual country reports on terrorism,
okay,
let's look at the 2023 one, provided it confirms that policy view.
Okay.
It says pretty plainly that Maduro's representatives gave safe haven to these Colombia origin groups, you know, the ones, ELN, the FARC-E faction, Segundo Marcatalia.
And it's not just looking the other way, right?
Right. No, not at all. The sources are quite clear on this. The phrasing they use is really telling. It's described as a kind of government non-state compact, not a crackdown.
The compact.
Yeah, basically enabling these groups to operate and profit. So what we're really talking about here isn't just, you know, some corrupt officials taking bribes. It's more like an institutionalized protection economy. The state, or parts of it, are selling security or maybe selling the lack of interference to criminal groups and militants operating right there inside Venezuela.
That phrase, institutionalized protection economy, that really clicks. It sets up what happened next perfectly, because that legal and diplomatic view then turned into real financial pressure. Where do the sources show the Treasury Department, OFAC, really targeting these networks?
Right. So Treasury, specifically OFAC, started putting names and, more importantly, financial blocks on these threats. They used that legal framework we just discussed to go after the logistics, the money. First up, they really zeroed in on the Tren de Aragua, or TDA.
Right, TDA, the group that started in Venezuelan prisons but just exploded across South America, a huge transnational criminal problem now.
Exactly. So OFAC sanctioned them on July 11, 2024. The initial designation was as a transnational criminal organization, a TCO. Pretty standard, in a way.
Okay.
But then, and this is key according to the sources, that designation got tougher in 2025. They rolled out expanded actions against TDA's leadership, but this time using terrorism-linked authorities.
Ah, so shifting the legal basis.
Precisely. That's the first big sign of these different toolboxes, counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism, starting to merge. Suddenly, TDA's ability to get funds for its leaders to travel, to get supplies, it's all restricted under a counterterrorism framework. Much more powerful.
Okay, but even bigger than TDA, the designation that must have really caused a stir was the next one. We're talking about the Cartel de los Soles, CDS, sanctioned on July 25, 2025.
Yes. That was the moment, I think, where the policy message became absolutely crystal clear. Treasury didn't just label them a TCO. They designated the Cartel de los Soles as a specially designated global terrorist entity. An SDGT.
And for you listening, that distinction, TCO versus SDGT, is huge, right?
It's night and day. A TCO designation targets the criminal activity, an SDGT designation. That automatically brings the entire weight of counterterrorism finance tools, international banking restrictions, legal jeopardy, everything. It's a much heavier hammer.
And the press release that came with it was incredibly direct. It described the CDS as, and I'm quoting here, a network headed by Nicolas Maduro that materially supports foreign terrorist organizations. And they specifically named TDA and even Mexico's Sinaloa cartel.
Yeah, that's the absolute core of it in these documents. Now, look, people debate whether the Cartel de los Soles is, you know, a formal structured organization like Cali or Medellin back in the day, or if it's more just a sort of brand name used by corrupt high-level military and political figures running protection rackets.
Does that distinction even matter at this point?
From a policy perspective, maybe not as much as you'd think. The implication of the designation is the same either way. Washington is now officially, on the record, treating powerful elements within the Venezuelan state elements explicitly linked to the very top as the terrorism-linked criminal enabler. That SDGT label basically says the state operation itself is materially supporting terror. And that changes everything for international banks, for security partners, for anyone doing business that might touch Venezuela.
Okay, so these are powerful designations, SDGT, TCO. Let's ground them now. How does this protection economy actually work day to day? The sources point to two key areas. Let's start with the Western Frontier, that infamous Catatumbo Arauca Basin on the border with Colombia.
Right. That region is almost the textbook example of what they call permissive terrain. It's this critical corridor. You've got clandestine airstrips, river crossings. It's perfect for moving everything illicit. Cocaine, cash, weapons, people, militants crossing back and forth. And the volatility there, it's constant. The sources confirm it.
Yeah, the documents mention that in early 2025, Colombia had to reactivate arrest warrants for ELN leaders because things were heating up so much in that zone. And then through spring and summer of 2025, the ELN was apparently bold enough to kidnap two Colombian prosecutor's office employees right there on the Arauca side, an incident the UN even commented on. And this was happening alongside huge spikes in people being displaced by the violence.
And the significance of Venezuela's side being labeled permissive terrain in official U.S. reports. It's huge, because when a government is formally assessed as providing safe haven to groups already designated as terrorists, like the ELN, well, the rules of engagement change.
How so?
The legal thresholds, the operational thresholds for things like interdiction, stopping shipments, tracking flights, they shift. The justification for more assertive action, whether that's financial pressure or even thinking about air maritime operations, it just becomes much stronger because the neighboring state is seen as part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Yeah, got it. Okay, now let's shift gears completely. Go across the country to the southeast, the Orinoco mining arc, mostly in Bolivar State. Here, the main illicit commodity isn't cocaine, it's gold. But the logic is similar.
The criminal logic, yes, it seems identical based on these reports. You have state elements allegedly facilitating and profiting from illegal resource extraction. And the documentation of the abuses tied to this mining is extensive.
Where's that coming from?
Well, notably, there's the UN Independent International Fact-Finding Mission. Their 2024 report detailed just rampant abuses in those mining zones, direct security force complicity in some cases, and near total impunity.
Wow.
And on top of that, you have warnings from groups like the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, IACHR. They're flagging the specific devastating harm being done to the Yanomami and other indigenous communities because of this illegal mining and the violence that comes with it. It's not just environmental damage. It's a human rights crisis fueled by this protection economy.
And underpinning all that illegal gold trade is infrastructure, right? The sources mention evidence of just pits everywhere, mines spreading, and crucially, Again, clandestine airstrips, lots of them, radiating out from hubs like Santa Elena de Orain.
Exactly. Gold, drugs, cash, guns,
yeah.
Whatever the high-value illicit cargo is, those airstrips are the common logistical backbone. They need those strips to move volume quickly and avoid scrutiny.
So if you look at those two zones, the western border for drugs, the southeast for gold, the common threads are state complicity, impunity.
And the infrastructure, especially those airstrips. They allow these designated criminal groups, these terrorist groups like ELN, to operate, knowing they're basically protected. That's the core of the protection economy in action.
And this isn't just based on reports or intelligence assessments, right? There are actual court cases that back this up. Let's connect these networks to specific people using U.S. court records. You mentioned this provides an evidentiary spine, not just rumors.
Precisely. And the most dramatic piece of evidence recently has to be the Carvajal plea. Hugo Carvajal, Popolo, former head of Venezuelan military intelligence, a very senior figure.
Right.
In June 2025, according to these dockets, he pleaded guilty in U.S. federal court. Not just to drug trafficking, but specifically to narco-terrorism and cocaine importation conspiracy. That is huge. You have a former spy chief basically admitting on the record in a U.S. court to the very state-sponsored trafficking that's been alleged for years.
That's a massive anchor point. And it wasn't the first time this kind of proximity was established legally, was it? We should probably remember the Narco Sobrinos case, too.
Absolutely. That set a precedent years earlier. Back in 2017, two nephews of Venezuela's first lady were sentenced to 18 years. Again, for plotting to ship cocaine to the U.S. So, taken together, Carvajal's plea, the Narco Sobrinos convictions, these court records establish, beyond rumor, both family links and senior state official links directly to drug trafficking. It's there in black and white.
Okay, so let's pull all these threads together then. We've got the 2020 DOJ charges, the 2023 State Department findings on Safe Haven, these incredibly strong 2025 sanctions, especially the SDGT tag on the Cartel de los Soles, linking it to Maduro, and now these guilty pleas and convictions. What does it all mean for actual policy going forward? The sources hint at a firmer U.S. posture, but maybe not necessarily regime change. What does that look like?
Yeah, it looks like what the sources call a strategy of cumulative pressure. It's about leveraging the fact that these different tools, counter-narcotics and counter-terrorism, now officially converge on the same targets.
Because TDA is terrorism-linked, and the Cartel de los Soles is a full-blown SDGT.
Exactly. So the goal isn't necessarily or solely about overthrowing the government. It's more about targeted economic pain, making it incredibly expensive, risky, and difficult to do business in these dirty lanes, as the sources put it, trying to raise the price of operating this protection economy until it becomes unsustainable for some of the actors involved.
Okay, so how do you do that? What are the specific choke points you target?
Well, for the mining arc, for instance, the sources suggest going after the whole logistics chain. Not just the miners, but the wholesalers buying the gold, the people supplying fuel to those clandestine airstrips, the middlemen handling the exports. You can use things like public compliance advisories.
What do those do?
They basically warn international banks, insurers, shipping companies, hey, if you deal with these specific actors or operate in these sectors, you risk exposure to U.S. terrorism sanctions. That gets people's attention very quickly. It chills legitimate business that might inadvertently touch the illicit stuff.
And what about the planes using those airstrips?
Aviation denial is critical. And it's not just about sanctioning a few specific planes, like trying to grab a particular tail number. The sources suggest a broader approach.
Like what?
Targeting the whole support network that keeps these planes flying. The brokers arranging flights, the registries where planes are flagged, the maintenance shops fixing them, even if those shops are outside Venezuela. If a plane is linked to an SDGT or being used to support terrorism, the legal basis to go after its entire support ecosystem becomes much, much stronger.
So it's a very calibrated, almost surgical approach to apply pressure. And the sources mentioned some historical examples, right? Of how states have dealt with other countries tangled up in narco economies.
Yeah, they mentioned a few precedents for trying to calibrate risk and pressure. Things like Panama back in 89 with Noriega, which obviously ended dramatically. But also Guinea-Bissau around 2013, where you saw rapid extraditions to break up what was essentially a narco-state node. Okay. And maybe a more current example is the sanction structure being built against Syria's Captagon trade.
Different situations, but similar dynamics.
Different contexts, for sure, but maybe a shared lesson. When a government, or powerful parts of it, acts like a protection racket for organized crime and militants, especially when those groups are designated terrorist supporters, then the tools of targeted financial warfare, counterterrorism, and traditional counter-narcotics inevitably start to blend together. It becomes a matter of regional security.
Okay, so to wrap this up, the bottom line here seems pretty clear from these documents. The crisis in Venezuela, as defined by the official U.S. record at least, is characterized by this protection economy. You've got criminal syndicates, you've got dissident militants like the ELN, and you have elements of the state all apparently working together, certainly coexisting and profiting.
Mm.
And the U.S. government's own actions, the DOJ charges, Carvajal's plea, the State Department's CRT findings, those heavy TDA and particularly CDS sanctions, they now provide the official justification for a much tougher, multi-pronged strategy, one that mixes interdiction, legal pressure, lawfare, and hitting those financial choke points hard.
Yeah, and maybe the final thought, the question for you, the listener, to really wrestle with based on everything we've seen in these sources is this. Given that explicit SDGT designation, the one that links the Cartel de los Soles directly to the head of state, how far can the international community actually push these legal and financial pressure points? At what point does the sheer weight of that labeled terrorism-linked protection economy force everyone to adopt a fundamentally new and perhaps much higher standard for what regional security policy requires?